Hello, everybody. This is Alexandra Metters of GalacticConnection.com, and today is August 26th, 2014. You can reach this radio show program at the BBS radio station 2, just in case you want to go back and check out archives. And this will be viewing live from 3 p.m. to 4:55 p.m. Tuesday. And if you can't find it after that, sometimes there's a little bit of a gap, so we put it up in the Vimeo section on the BBS radio page, just in case you guys are trying to find it. So I have a really interesting guest today. And people are probably saying, yeah, you say that all the time. But seriously, I know everybody is very well aware of Jim Nichols, and he's a very prominent UFO researcher and artist. And I think you'll find the conversation today is very timely. It was very synchronistic when he and I connected on the phone. He has a very interesting background. I was going to actually ask you about this, Jim. Notice that you kind of got saved by not having to be in the Vietnam War for too terribly long. I was looking at your bio. But anyway, he was born in Ohio. And he basically decided that he had a lot of good abilities in commercial art, and he decided to pursue that. Ended up going into investigations with UFO illustrations, publishing internationally in magazines and articles, books, and the internet. He also created not only art, but books with a lot of art in them, which I would really like to see that, Jim. He has become a prolific writer. He's posted 21 blog essays. And, of course, you can reach his website at jimnicholsufo.net. He examines exopolitics, and this is the part that I find you do such a great job by really summarizing what's going on from a political and social perspective regarding the extraterrestrial realities of our society. And that's what we're going to dive in today. And you will find a lot of his illustrations as well as his stories and visions and research, et cetera, up on the YouTube movie channel. He has quite a few. I think you have 14 up there, right?
No, seven.
Seven. Oh, you dropped
seven. Yeah, okay. We pared it down to seven.
Oh, okay. And for those of you that haven't seen his paintings, man, really good, beautiful paintings of southwestern landscapes. I'm most impressed with that. So a lot of interesting stuff. I people know I don't really typically go into a huge bio background. You'll be able to read a lot of the details on the site. But for now, let's go ahead and get started. And welcome, Jim. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Alexander. Thanks for having me. This is this is delightful. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, I am too. And, you know, I kind of was – your site is fairly big. And I sat there and kind of scratched my head as to where you wanted to begin. And I know that what's been kind of near and dear to your heart is the Aeon of Horus, right?
Well, yeah. It's my most recent blog is always the one that's most dear to my heart. But actually, no, they all are. They're all my blogs really span. God, I hate to admit it, but 44 years of UFO research. I've been chipping away at this mystery for 44 years.
Hey, there's something special about that number, you know.
44, magic number, huh? Anyway, since 1980, I really got seriously involved with UFO research, and primarily due to an association that I made that year with Wendell Stevens.
Yes.
You know Wendell Stevens. And
Lieutenant Colonel, right?
Lieutenant Colonel, former Air Force military pilot.
Gee, I can relate to that.
Yeah, I bet you can. Well, anyway, that was taking the red pill in the Matrix, and I've been going down the rabbit hole ever since.
Well, that's kind of what happens when you're affiliated with the Air Force, isn't it? In any way, shape, or form.
Well, yeah, and it's like, you know, Wendell warned me. Wendell, right from the get-go, he says, you know, interest in this field can radically change your life. And I said, oh, come on, Wendell, that's a little overdramatic. But in hindsight, he was absolutely right.
I think so, too. And I just have to tell the audience, I mean, they know that I've been very dedicated to diving into a lot of the details with the Lie NASA Told video. And I want everybody to know that Jim has done the same. So this is very interesting that he's going to be able to bring in some more pearls of wisdom to add to this whole unfolding of information, especially in relation to the in relation to NASA and Aleister Crowley. And I would really wanted to kind of start there as far as, you know, you talked about him being a self-proclaimed Satanist and that NASA had actually gotten its start very much involved with him and the whole occult practitioners. Can you talk a little bit about that as far as what you found?
Well, golly, that's a huge, that's 2 hours worth right there.
Well, it's such a big deal right now. You know, everybody's really got their eyes on NASA right now.
NASA. Well, let's see. It starts with a guy named Jack Parsons. It starts with, Jet Propulsion Laboratory back just before World War II when a gang of Caltech researchers were playing around in the Arroyo Seco there and next to Pasadena trying to develop solid fuel rockets. And they called these guys the Suicide Squad because they kept blowing themselves up.
Oh, that's too funny, which they typically are. I mean, they really
are
agreed to themselves, aren't they?
Yeah, they were crazy guys, but they were very successful in developing some really sophisticated solid fuel rockets, which were eventually incorporated into the military thanks to World War II. So it's really World War II and the scientific expertise of a guy named Jack Parsons that put the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on the map. And, of course, then over the years after the war, JPL was instrumental in working with NASA in developing Mars probe launches and, of course, with the Apollo launches.
So where did the ritual sex magic come in?
I was just jumping right into it. Huh? Okay. Well, aside from being a brilliant rocket designer and scientist, Jack Parsons also had a flair for the occult. And he was a great devotee of the beast himself, Aleister Crowley. Okay? And so much so that he and Aleister Crowley developed an association where Aleister Crowley established one of his Ordo Templi Orientis lodges in Pasadena. Of course, Aleister Crowley was from Great Britain, but and he had been involved in contacting extraterrestrials or extradimensionals as far back as 1904.
Wow.
1904. Wow. So, anyway, Jack Parsons was so enamored of Aleister Crowley that he referred to Crowley as his beloved father.
Oh, that's kind of scary.
And eventually Jack Parsons became the master or the high priest of the Ordo Templi Orientis in Pasadena.
Now, Jim, I got to ask you something.
Okay.
Why did they call him the Great Beast?
That's what he called himself. He
why?
Aleister Crowley, from a very early age, he was kind of very intellectual, very rebellious, and he totally rejected the conventional Christianity of Victorian England. In the era that he was born, and he wanted to be the great Satan. He wanted to be 666. His ambition was to be in league with Satan right from the get-go.
Wow.
And so he later on, in later life, he joined the Order of the Golden Dawn, and he became a 33rd degree Freemason. And he was determined to break down the barriers, as he perceived it, of established Christianity in the Victorian era.
Now, what is the significance of the Thelema? You know, he called the sexual magic ritual Thelema.
Wow. Need to back up a little bit. In 1904, Aleister Crowley got married. Now, let's see, I forget the name of his wife. Anyway, his wife was Rose. He married Rose in 1904. And on their honeymoon, they went to Cairo, Egypt. And within the Great Pyramid, he and his newlywed wife, Rose Edith Kelly, they conducted a magical sex ritual within the Great Pyramid.
Whoa.
Okay. So, the next morning, they went back to the hotel. The next morning, his wife, Rose, was acting very strange. And she was like in a semi-trance. And she kept saying to Alistair, she says, "They're waiting for you. They're waiting for you."
Oh,
and I was like, Alistair said, you know, he said, "Who's waiting for me?" I was like, "What are you talking about?" So, and Rose was not into the occult, and she was not into ancient Egyptian mythology whatsoever. So to try to figure out what was going on with Rose, he took her to the Cairo Museum. And she kind of got kind of frantic, and she was going from display case to display case throughout the museum. And she finally stopped at this one display case. Glass display case, which happened to be number 666.
Wow.
And within the display case, there was an effigy or a sculpture, whatever, of the god Horus. And she says, "That's him. That's who's trying to contact you." And so Aleister Crowley, they went back to the hotel, and Rose also mysteriously proclaimed to Aleister Crowley that the equinox of the gods has come. And so from that point, Aleister Crowley, for the next 3 days, in early afternoon, was contacted by an extra-dimensional, extraterrestrial entity called Iwas, who just by the merest coincidence looks just like a gray.
I was just going to ask you that. Yeah.
Yeah. And this guy says, "I am a god of war and vengeance." And then he dictated to Crowley a work called The Book of the Law, which prophesied wars and revolutions leading to the collapse of Christian civilizations and the dawn of the Aeon of Horus.
Wow.
So, it is... Okay, within the Book of the Law was proclaimed the Law of Thelema, which is usually summed up in three mantra-like verses, which are, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," "Love is the law, love under will," and "Every man and every woman is a star." So this kicked off... this kicked off an extraordinary age of occult mysticism that eventually worked its way into Jet Propulsion Lab and eventually worked very profoundly into the NASA Apollo projects.
That's just amazing. Wow.
Okay.
So, I mean, they don't pick names like Thelema by accident. I mean, do you know what the history is or the,
Thelema is a Greek word that means will or intention.
Okay, interesting.
And apparently Crowley was the whole, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," which means follow your own will or intention.
Well, that's not bad.
But if everybody's doing that, it seems like total chaos.
I was going to say, if you're not considering other people.
Exactly. So, so essentially, that Well, anyway, Iwas went on to tell Crowley that Crowley was initiating a new era, a new age, that we had gone through the age of Isis, which was more of a maternal authoritarian rule. Okay. And then it was followed by the Aeon of Osiris, which was patriarchal. And the child of Isis and Osiris is Horus. So now we are in the age of Horus. And if you look at how NASA is influenced by Crowley, how Crowley has totally influenced the music industry. He was a profound influence on people like Ian Fleming, writers like Robert Heinlein and Ray Bradbury. It's like the influence of Crowley in our contemporary society is extraordinary.
God, that's amazing. So I noticed as I was reading through your site that he was very involved in, like, portal activations.
Yes.
And I was tripping out on that.
Right.
Wow. Talk a little bit about how he supposedly widened this portal. And
okay. Now, when I tell you this, I want you to think about the original movie Ghostbusters.
Okay.
In March 1918, Aleister Crowley went to New York City. And in a Central Park West apartment, he conducted another ritual sex magic ritual called the Amalantra Workings. And this time he connected with an entity called LAM, L-A-M.
Whoa.
So it's like Central Park West, that's exactly what you see in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
It's a portal is open in a Central Park West apartment that just happens, you know, to contact hyperdimensional beings. Well, that's exactly precisely what Aleister Crowley was doing.
And I suppose that's not too far away from the Twin Towers, right?
Well, it's not too far away. He went out to Montauk, Long Island, and conducted ceremonies out there. And, of course, you know how notorious Montauk is.
Yes.
With very bizarre top-secret experiments and so forth there. So I'm sure that there is a dimensional or portal connection with Montauk as well.
God, so we don't even really know if that portal was actually created by Crowley himself before Montauk was even launched.
Right.
Wow. That's one thing I did not know. I did not know about that. That was very interesting.
So did they just, you know, were the powers that be, were they aware that there was a portal opened at Montauk, and so they just, well, let's put a top-secret facility out there and just keep working with it?
Unbelievable.
That's just speculation on my part. But
now, you also talked, Jim, about, okay, I have to tell you, probably one of the most creeped-out movies I've ever seen in my entire life was Rosemary's Baby.
Mm-hmm.
That movie left such an impression on me when I was young.
Right.
And when I saw that this was directly related with Crowley, I was curious, has there been any kind of confirmation that he truly was trying to create some demon seed child? I mean, you know,
I'm not so sure that was Crowley's intention. That was Jack Parsons' intention, and that happened later in the 40s, mid-40s. But getting back to Aleister Crowley in New York, Crowley stated, he says, "My observation of the universe convinces me that there are beings of intelligence and power of a far higher quality than anything we can conceive of as human, that they are not necessarily based on the cerebral and nervous structures that we know, and that the one and only chance for mankind to advance as a whole is for individuals to make contact with such beings. So that's what he was trying to do with his Amalantra workings in New York. He was trying to make telepathic contact with super intelligent hyperdimensional beings. And apparently he was very successful in doing that. But it was Jack Parsons later on that really tried to create the Rosemary's Baby kind of thing.
Good God. I mean, do you know much more other than that regarding Parsons?
Parsons is quite a story. Okay. Well, anyway, apparently Crowley did open a rift between the spaces between the stars in New York in 1918. Okay?
Okay.
So we already had that portal opened. And I keep thinking about, you know, the Book of Revelations talks about opening the seals. It's always talking about opening the seals. And I just wonder if the seals were referenced to these portals where astral beings had been sealed so they couldn't access our reality. And now he pops a hole in our reality to just let them come flooding in.
That makes a lot of sense because in some of the other texts that I've read, it is directly correlated with the stargates.
Right.
Which have been deliberately shut down to prevent some of the nasties from, you know, totally taking over our planet. I mean, it's not just sort of taking over our planet.
Well, if you really get into the history of, you know, Babylonian ritual magic and mysticism, it's like that was the whole purpose of that, was to open up, you know, these our reality to virtually unlimited access by demonic beings.
Good God.
So, anyway, let's get back to Jack Parsons, okay?
That's a nice positive thought, huh, Jim? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, something to make you feel cozy at bedtime.
No kidding.
In 1945, Jack Parsons was high priest of Crowley's Agape Lodge in Pasadena, where he was joined by another mysterious practitioner who went by the name of Frater H. The secret name was Frater H. And together, Frater H. and Jack Parsons went to work on the Babylon working ritual sex magic attempt to open up another portal and to create a demonic Rosemary's Baby kind of entity. Okay? And even Crowley himself was concerned that Jack Parsons may have been getting into something he wasn't really skilled to deal with. And as it turns out, the mysterious Frater H was none other than L. Ron Hubbard.
Wow.
So, I mean, this just gets better and better all the time. So, anyway, they were joined by another mysterious lady by the name of Marjorie Cameron, she was a striking blue-eyed redhead who had been a cartographer working for the Department of Defense in Washington.
So there's another connection with the DOD.
Right. Funny thing. So she and Jack Parsons became involved sexually. And she volunteered to be the vehicle for Parsons to create his moon child, which would have been essentially Rosemary's Baby.
Wow.
And according to Marjorie Cameron, she was impregnated during one of these rituals by Jack Parsons. And this is where it gets really interesting. Really interesting. Now, the rest of the story is that before the child was born, she was taken to, I think, Los Alamos.
Oh, my God.
Where the fetus was removed by the people working on the atomic bomb project.
Oh, sweet.
And what they wanted to do was create a creature that was like half human, half demonic. And this is just high octane speculation on my part, that this could have been an entity that was used to create artificial little grays.
What else popped in my head was the Antichrist.
Well, essentially they would be. It's not like, I suspect there has been no evidence of a single Antichrist entity or personality that came from this ritual.
Okay. Interesting.
As far as, you know, as far as Marjorie Cameron was concerned, they came, they took the fetus, and the Manhattan Project scientists took the fetus, and exactly what they did with it remains a mystery.
Wow.
Okay.
That's what I was going to ask you. So nothing has been written or speculated about where this so-called fetus ended up?
Well, if you want to have some more high octane speculation, let's go to, have you watched the interview with, Carrie Cassidy and Stephen Greer?
I have, yes.
Okay.
It's been a while.
This is 2009. Go back and listen to like the first 15 minutes of that interview, because, Stephen Greer lets the cat out of the bag, but I'm shocked that Carrie Cassidy and Bill Ryan didn't jump all over it. Because Stephen Greer stated that he knows people who have worked in facilities in Dulce, New Mexico, and in Pine Gap, Australia, and other places where they have actually been growing the gray and reptilian species that people think are ETs.
Interesting.
She says they are absolutely what are called nanobio machines. They are programmed life forms. And there is no question that such is going on. And then he went further and stated that we have some at Lockheed and another program, which he couldn't say where it was, but he stated it was in the South, in an underground facility, and the chief scientist was somebody he knew personally very well. And he went on to say, they have developed electromagnetic systems where they can put someone in a state they can go into and get this. And this, he says, and this gets into cosmologically complex discussions, but a lower astral or denser astral field, which some would call demonic, and they can actually see beings and creatures there and bring them in three-dimensional and into our three-dimensional reality and materialize them into flesh and blood.
You know, what pops in my head, Jim, is I interviewed Karen Hudis. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her.
Yeah.
And she made one statement that really stuck in my mind. And many of her contacts are with the military.
Yeah.
And she stated that, I think she said a two-star told her that there was no such things as actual UFOs, that they were basically projections of our mind.
Okay.
And she stated that it was all, you know, she was basically, I forgot the exact words, but it was basically insinuating that all of these aliens that we see are projected in our minds, you know, to scare the bejesus out of us, you know, like for when it comes to abductions and things like this, which does not eliminate the person that's been abducted of it feeling like an incredibly real experience.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
You know, and yeah. I'm going to go on record to state that, but
sure.
I'm wondering if this is one and the same. I mean, are they actually literally pulling a matter, an organic form, or are they actually just creating an artificial intelligence, you know, through a digital means?
Okay, well, this gets into the discussion of what is the real?
That's true.
what is the real? And what we think is real is actually a projection in the back of our brains that where our physical senses are recording codes. It's like in the Matrix. All we see are codes. But there are those codes go into the back of our brain where it retranslates them into the visual world we think we see and the thing we think is real. Mm-hmm. Okay? And what's interesting, there's a Dr. Eric Strassman? Mm-hmm. Rick Strassman. Dr. Rick Strassman has been speculating that near-death experience and also the ET abduction experience comes from the release of DMT inside our own brains.
Interesting.
So the DMT is the spirit molecule that activates your pineal gland. Mm-hmm. And people who have had DMT experiences clinically claim that they have seen realms of extraterrestrials and aliens and grays and reptilians and flying saucers and all the archetypal things that people describe in UFO abduction or UFO sighting cases can be automatically triggered by the release of DMT in your brain. Hmm. Now, he argues that's like an LSD hallucination. The flip side is that DMT is actually allows your consciousness to enter hyperdimensional realms of reality. Mm. That we coexist even here as we speak with multidimensional hyperdimensional realities.
Yeah.
And that this universe that we think is all that is just one little teeny tiny fragment of multiverses that exist in a hyperdimensional field.
Agreed.
Now, is that totally confusing?
Does that make sense? No, it does make sense.
You're following me with it.
Yeah.
So what is the real? So if I look in the sky, I think I see a UFO, but you know, even the sky that I'm looking at is nothing more than signals being interpreted in the back of my brain.
Well, and I'm also thinking about what you said. If they delved into the second dimension, mm-hmm. then that probably was because they created a portal into the second dimension.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm
trying to picture that.
So, the whole UFO field is very misleading because it makes you focus on extraterrestrials on other planets and flying machines from other planets, and it's like, and you have the illusion that this is coming from someplace very far away.
I agree. And the other thing, go ahead.
No, it ain't coming from far away. It's right there in your own living room. It's right as close as you're breathing because we're in this hyperdimensional soup. So it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
I think when I went to a contact conference where we were just doing CE5 training,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and one of the biggest ahas for me was recognizing the fact that everything I was seeing in the skies, whether it was, flashing lights or actual UFOs, or maybe there was some signaling going on, or maybe some red flashes, things like that, I began to realize that all of that was directly associated with the feelings that I was emoting and the love that I was projecting from my heart.
Right.
And that, to me, was a very major moment. And that really hit home as to the fact that we see the UFOs, we see the so-called aliens, which I don't like to call them that, but, extraterrestrials or galactic brothers and sisters, we mm-hmm. see them outside ourselves when in fact right. it's really a connection in our own, as you say, multidimensional soup.
Sure.
Totally different way of seeing things.
Right.
Anyway, so where did we leave off?
Where do we go from here?
So we were talking about Parsons and Rosemary's Baby and the Manhattan Project.
Yeah. So that's kind of, well, actually, I have to go back. It was that video you mentioned, the lie NASA told.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, guys sent me the link to that when that first came out. And she says, you got to see this. So I watched it. And I don't know if how familiar your audience is with it.
Oh,
but it
sure.
Blew my mind. It's like, I didn't know what to make of it. It was so far out, and it's, and yet I with some of the other research I had done, I could follow along with a lot of the things she was saying about the ancient Babylon mystery schools, and she seemed to be really right on target with that.
Definitely.
But
how about the planets on the poles?
I still can't get a handle on that one. But anyway. But the thing she was saying about NASA that put me on this trip. So, well, okay, what is going on with NASA? What is so strange about NASA? And so I started doing some research. I went back and looked at the book that Mike Barra and Richard Hoagland published, Dark Mission. And so, now I get it. Now I'm starting to get a handle on this. This whole Jack Parsons and NASA and JPL mystery and how it relates to all of this. But what I found really interesting is that within the hierarchy of NASA, there are three powerful occult groups. And there's, of course, Wernher von Braun and the Nazis. And then there's a powerful Freemason group at the very top of NASA. And then, of course, there's Jack Parsons and the Aleister Crowley magicians that are also highly placed within NASA. And one of the things that the extraterrestrial kind of alluded to with Aleister Crowley back in 1918, I think it was, it suggested that there were artifacts to be found on both the moon and Mars.
Right. Right.
And so the obsession with a secret Mars or a secret Mars mission, yes, for one, and a secret moon mission, apart from what was shown to the public with the Apollo landings, suddenly made perfect sense.
It did. It did fill in some holes for me. And, you know, the other thing I was going to mention, I noticed you talked about how Crowley died of heroin addiction.
Yeah, yes.
And Parsons died of, I think it was some sort of explosion.
Yeah, he blew himself up.
And then yes. L. Ron Hubbard died of a stroke.
Yes.
Now, did Crowley even have any kind of heroin addiction to begin with? Is there any kind of testimony stating that
yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was destitute and he was a heroin addict. He had some kind of physical disorder that the only way he could get a relief from it was the heroin.
Mm.
And what's interesting, there's a testimony. If you go, there's a little documentary you can find online about the life of Aleister Crowley, and there's this lady that was his companion at the time of his death, and she said that when he died, there was this huge thunderclap, and this huge, this powerful wind came blowing through the window.
Wow.
In itself. Now that's interesting. And then Jack Parsons died in an explosion in his home in Pasadena in June of 1952, and 1 month later, there was the massive UFO sighting over Washington, D.C.
Now that was interesting. Now, before you go to that, I thought the fact that the Navy supposedly had told, you know, jumping ahead, the Navy had told Parsons, hadn't he, to break up the black magic cult?
Well, allegedly, L. Ron Hubbard was sent by the Navy, by Navy intelligence, to break up the Parsons occult activities. Actually, Parsons, JPL bought him out in 1944 because his craziness was getting to be a liability for JPL.
I was wondering.
So by 1945, Parsons and Hubbard and Marjorie Cameron were kind of on their own.
They were becoming too much of a liability for them.
Yes. Yeah, they were just getting too weird.
What's your feeling about this Book of the Law? You know, I mean, is there a comparison between that and, the law of one raw material? Is there any kind of comparison at all?
I'm not going to go into that because I haven't really read the whole book, the
okay.
Book of the Law. All I would say is, one of the cryptic things that Curly said was that after I die, you're going to realize that I created the 20th century.
Whoa!
And he said, you look back on how much occult influence has spread throughout our mainstream culture since then, it's like, wow, he was really right on target. I mean, you look at... Most of your big name rock musicians, the Beatles, Jim Morrison, the Rolling Stones, were heavily influenced by Aleister Crowley.
Oh,
Madonna, Britney Spears, Katy Perry. Katy Perry is a self-styled Satanist herself.
Yeah, she's kind of...
You know that. Yeah. And she admitted that, you know, at age 15, she sold her soul to the devil.
You know, it's, Jim, everywhere I'm going right now, they are giving her tickets away when you make a purchase at a store.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, come on, folks, you got to think twice about that.
Right.
It's like, why are they giving away free tickets to a concert, you know?
Yeah, have you, I don't know if you've seen her her rock video, what's the name of it?
Oh, it's got all the ancient Egyptian.
The Egyptian one, yes.
Yes, I saw
it. She's
it.
Standing up on top of an obelisk, and she's the goddess Isis herself.
Yes.
So, how's, you know, this is about, you know, it's about as subtle as a cockroach going across a white rug.
Subtlety? No, that's not in their vocabulary.
No, it's like you're just getting hammered over the head with it now. and then you've got, you can't have the Super Bowl anymore without having a Babylon sex ritual halftime,
that's
you know,
true.
With Madonna. And it's like, it's everywhere.
It
you know,
is.
Alexander, I'm saying, it is everywhere. And
that I created the 20th century.
I created that. And so much of the MK Ultra mind control projects are Crowley based. MI6, MI5 in Britain are heavily influenced by Crowley and stuff. It's like, damn. Of course, he was involved with British Secret Service during the war.
So, do you think that's where he really started getting his information? I mean, was this guy clairvoyant from a very early age?
Yeah.
Did he have a lot of gifts?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And he did a lot of nasty stuff. He had a home on the banks of Loch Ness in Scotland.
Oh, interesting. God, don't tell me he created the Loch Ness monster.
Well, use your imagination, right?
I was gonna say.
Use your imagination. So anyway, he was a busy boy during his life. I got to give him that.
God. Well, you did ask a question on your site, and I thought it was a very poignant one, and it says, you know, explain the driving motivation behind the relentless perpetuation of secret societies.
Yeah.
You know, what is really the ultimate driving motivation? Is it truly to come up with the three scenarios of where they're going to put humanity in the time of a potential, so-called alien invasion or cataclysm of the planet? Or is it actually just to continue to control us, keep us dumbed down, you know?
Let me refer you back to another one of my blogs, which is Secret Societies and Flying Saucers. Okay. And I have to take my hat off to Joseph P. Farrell on this one. Joseph Farrell, you can go to his website, which is GizaDeathStar.com. He has written a body of, he has done a body of research that is just extraordinary. But his main thesis is that what we see in contemporary Western civilization is a deliberate attempt to recreate the ancient alchemical magical civilization of Babylon. Ritual, magic, occult magic, everywhere you turn, and it all relates back to the high civilization, the high spiritual technology, alchemical spiritual technology of ancient Babylon.
That's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
Totally different way of looking at it.
Yeah, but you'll see at the end of the day, it all flows together. It all ends up at the same place. Because what they're trying to do, and this is, and this relates to ancient Babylon magic, it relates to ancient Jewish magic, it specifically relates to the Kabbalah. The secret magic of the Kabbalah, which essentially is to have the magical ability to manipulate physical reality. To manipulate the fabric of physical reality. And that's what magic is, right?
Yes, correct.
Right. So, this, it's not mystical mumbo jumbo. This was a specific technology that we perceive of as, well, it's magic. But you use, You use number codes, you use chants, you use music, you use incense, all the occult accoutrements that go on with magical alchemy are essentially a technology, and it's a preserved technology from ancient civilizations. So then you have to ask yourself, okay, then why were these three occult groups that were in, have gained top control at NASA, why were they so obsessed with getting to the moon at a specific day, at a specific time, to be in alignment with the star Sirius, the constellation Osiris, and to be at the 33rd parallel on the moon?
And what's the answer?
Well, we're still working on that one, but it has some kind of powerful occult significance. And then you have to ask yourself, well, who? There's a gentleman, and who better to organize the landing schedule for the Apollo moon landings, but an Egyptian?
I know, I saw that.
Dr. Farouk Elbaz.
Yeah, that was very, very coincidental. Coincidental.
Hey, this, you know, it's like, you couldn't make this stuff up.
No.
Dr. Farouk Elbaz was born in Cairo, Egypt. Cairo means Mars in Egyptian, actually. He was educated in the United States, was a geologist, taught in Germany and the United States before becoming involved with NASA's space program in 1967. And actually he applied for a position with Bellcom, which was a corporation that handled the NASA's communications systems for the Apollo program. Well, he suddenly went from communications to being the single sole proprietor for selecting the actual landing sites for the Apollo program.
And he determined the grids, I thought.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay.
Time, the grids, everything. Because he was solely responsible. They said his was the most important job in NASA for the Apollo project.
Okay, now hold on a second. Now, this goes back to the lie NASA told. She talks about the so-called grid around the planet, that it's actually real.
Yes.
Now, that we think it's not, but it's actually real. And a lot of people, including myself, have delved into that little piece and found that those grids are like electromagnetic highways.
Right.
Do you think the same applies with Mars?
It wouldn't surprise me at all.
And do you think this is what he's tapped into?
It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. Now, Elbaz, it just so happens that Elbaz's father was an expert in the ancient Egyptian stellar religions of Isis and Osiris. So essentially you have the son of an expert on the Osiris cults picking the landing sites where all the occult stellar alignments took place on the moon. So my question is this. What is the magic? What is the occult magic in the constellation Orion, the occult magic in the star Sirius, that this is still, to this day, going back all the way to ancient Egypt, why is this still so powerfully viable in our modern high-tech civilization? What is the secret magic to all of this?
I really think, though, that the purity of the teachings stems from the science of the sun.
Okay.
That's where I think it begins. Okay.
Well, this is where we need to talk to the lady who produced Lies and Acetol, because I'm sure she could answer this very quickly.
Yeah, no, that's crossed my mind too after I watched her.
Right, it's like, why? We're educated to believe that all those ancient Egyptian religions and so forth were just quaint mythologies, and nobody today takes them seriously. Well, guess what? Somebody at NASA takes them with deadly seriousness.
Okay, now I'm going to throw this out there and see what you think. Now, you've seen some of the ancient pictures of the high priests and high priestesses of ancient Egypt.
Yeah.
And they kind of have this, kind of humongous thing hanging over the side. It's like it covers their forehead, and then it comes down to almost, shoulder level. And it's like a piece of cloth.
Oh, it's a headdress, yeah.
Right, but haven't you ever wondered to yourself, why is it so full, and why is it so thick, and why does it stick out so far from the head?
Well, it's because the sun is so bright in Egypt, you need the shade. I'm being a smartass, but I see people out here working on the streets and the highways here in Tucson, and they wear shades very similar to that. Now I'm going to ask you a question. I'll throw it right back at you on the headdress of the pharaohs and the queens. Why is it they always show a vulture and a serpent?
Because I believe those represent, I think everything always gets back to a trinity.
Right.
Of the Father, the Son, and the Child.
Right.
And that there's all these metaphysical issues between each party. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the Son, meaning Horus, which actually kind of represents us.
Right.
And how we're pretty pissed off because we were created, in a combination of the so-called maybe serpent / reptilian.
Right.
Okay. And the human, which is the mother, which could represent Sophia. I mean, that would be mm-hmm. I would take it. But
okay.
I didn't. What I was going to tell you regarding the headdress is, there is no accident that dog is the, what would you call that, anagram of God. It's like the total unconditional love. No matter what you do to a dog, they still come back and they love you.
Okay.
Unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
of course, the dog star is what?
Sirius.
Of course. So there's something to do with Sirius and the fact that we have such a strong connection. And, in fact, I believe what did somebody just tell me the other day? That on the outskirts of Sirius, one of the most major planetary races comes from the – I was very surprised to hear it. So I think there's just – I think that that's like our direct link.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm thinking. And I think that's why they probably know all the astrological background of it. Don't forget that the original zodiac was based on 12 animals.
Right.
So, you know, which I would like to delve into that a little more deeply myself because okay. I don't know enough about
it. Well, I know that Sirius represents ISIS.
Correct, yeah.
And Orion represents Osiris.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you see them go through the night sky, they're always together. They're always together. And you see the representation with the three pyramids in Egypt of the belt stars in the constellation Orion. Mm. And they said that the River Nile flowing alongside the pyramids is analogous to the Milky Way, which flows alongside Orion.
Interesting. And then think about the galactic history of Orion.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The fact that it got blown to smithereens.
Yeah.
So what is that representing metaphysically, right?
Well, was that the destruction of Osiris, where Isis had to put him back together again?
Maybe.
And that Horus is actually the reincarnation of Osiris via Immaculate Conception of Isis.
Mm. Ooh, did you just come up with that, or have you already read about this?
No, that's the mythology.
I'm giving you a hard time. No, that's.
And I could tell you more, but I you know, there was one part of Osiris that was missing. I'm sure you're aware of that.
I don't know where you're going with this. Go ahead.
You remember which part that was?
There was a part of Osiris missing.
There were, yeah. She put Osiris back together, but one part was missing.
I don't know if I want to. Are you setting me up for something?
Well, I'm setting you up, but I'm serious about it. Also the phallus, which is
that's where you were going.
The phallus that is stands in front of the Vatican in Rome is an Egyptian obelisk that represents the phallus of Osiris.
Yes. I had a feeling that's where you were going with it. So not to totally change gears, but one of the topics that you just kind of touched upon very briefly in one of your blog posts was the Knights Templar.
Yes.
And I just really want you to open this subject up. You said something about how they had gone into the secret chambers under the Solomon's Temple, and they found a bunch of information there. But the one thing you said that they found was the secret of the physical matter can be transformed molecule by molecule by the use of incantations of ancient Hebrew letters and numbers, and that the nature of reality is really an illusion. Do you know any more about it than that?
Well, you would have to become a student of the Kabbalah.
Mm.
It is the Kabbalah. Somehow the King of France found out about these ancient Jewish mystical, magical rituals and texts. And so, you know, just by a merest coincidence, he sends these nine knights down to spend the night in Solomon's Temple.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And these nine glorious knights are supposed to guard the pilgrim trail to the Holy Land. Well, I don't see how nine poor knights can possibly maintain, you know, security on a trail that's that long.
Yeah.
So I strongly suspect there was something else that they were looking for. And apparently it was the Kabbalah, that they had learned about this Hebrew magic, which actually is ancient Babylonian magic, mm-hmm. that they desperately wanted to get their hands on. And so apparently they did.
I was wondering if you knew about the fact that they actually started an archaeological excavation at the Mount Moriah, which led them to the Temple of King Herod, which then led them to the Solomon's Temple.
Well, essentially, you know, Herod had rebuilt Solomon's Temple.
But, I mean, it supposedly it took them, like, 9 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
To find this amazing information. And the story right. goes that whatever they found, it took them over a year to travel to the Vatican and back. I mean, the Knights Templar were supposedly known as the other Vatican. They were never subservient to the Vatican. They had an
absolutely.
Incredible amount of power.
And absolutely.
They were very supernatural beings, yes. you know, high priests and priestesses. And
uh-huh.
I thought that was interesting.
So it wasn't so much the Ark of the Covenant that you saw in Indiana Jones that they were looking for. It was these magic texts. Because with these magic texts, they could create anything. They could turn lead into gold. They could exert power over princes and popes. I mean, this really was the Holy Grail really was this magic technology that they were looking for. And as the story goes, they did find it. And it made its way back into Europe, where it was translated into Latin. And just by the strangest coincidence, all your most powerful magical incantations these days are all spoken in Latin.
Interesting, which is the same.
So this secret magic wormed its way into the highest levels of the Vatican. So every pope, every king, every principality in Europe wanted to get their hands on this stuff just simply because they wanted it for their own greedy power.
Which then led to the demise of the Knights Templar.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Well, okay.
Very terrible way.
There's more than that. The King of France.
Sure.
The Knights Templar were the bank for the King of France.
Yes.
And the King of France always had to go begging to the Knights Templar for his financing. And then the King had this brilliant idea. He says, wow, he says, if they would initiate me into the Templar order, then I would have access to my money. And the Knights Templar said no.
Right. Yeah,
I love it. He said, no, King, you can't be one of our group.
Right.
Well, that pissed off the king big time. So then the king got in cahoots with the pope, and between the two of them, they did away with the Knights Templar, or they thought they did.
You know, it's interesting because it states that a lot of the years that they were in existence,
yes.
they were on very good terms with the Vatican and the popes.
Yes.
And in fact, the story goes that the information was leaked by the Pope that they were going to arrest all the Knights Templars. So about a month beforehand,
right.
they saved thousands of them.
Yes, yes. Plus, a lot of them just went to Germany or Britain because the Brits and the Germans, they really weren't interested in executing the Templars. I mean, for God's sakes, these guys are the bankers of Europe. So you don't want to upset the apple cart here.
Absolutely.
So essentially the Templars just broke up into other secret societies, and especially like Freemasons. Most of Freemasonry relates back to the Templars.
Well, what do you feel as far as when they supposedly escaped? Do you feel that they took these, you know, very magical text and so on and so forth, such as the Ark of the Covenant as well. Do you think that they took them up to Scotland and Ireland and England? And
I think a lot of it was actually hidden in France also.
Mm-hmm.
I think they what they took with them was the occult teachings, the occult knowledge, more than artifacts.
Okay.
And I think that's what... it would be interesting to have access to some of the libraries in the various Freemasonic lodges around the country, especially Washington, D.C.
Oh, I bet.
Because I'm sure that there are – you would discover a completely different history of the world in those archives than what is generally accepted in the general public.
Well, yeah, because history's totally been rewritten by
– Right, right.
The, Well, I actually say the losers, but they always make themselves out to be the winners.
Exactly. And even it was Albert Pike, General Freemason, General Albert Pike from the Civil War era, 33rd degree Freemason, said that truth is not for those who are unworthy or unable to receive it or would pervert it. The truth must be kept secret, and the masses need a teaching proportioned to their imperfect reason. So it's like, that's what we got. So, what is the real? What is the real? What are the real secrets? What is the real history of the world that we've never been allowed to know?
Well, and that leads me to my question about the Arctic and the Antarctic. And I did not know that 150 fighter pilots, like bombers, were basically obliterated with this really advanced technology by the Germans, and then they just disappeared.
Okay, wait. What is your source on that?
When I was reading your story, as they got closer to the end of the war, and supposedly they were using some advanced German, you know, the Germans had access to this advanced weaponry and supposed, you know, UFO type ships.
Right.
And I thought that I had read that like 150 of the Allied forces, the pilots, literally disappeared. Like they could shoot something in the range of their plane and it would just obliterate the plane.
Oh, that was that was during World War II. That was the Schweinfurt raid, the ball bearing plant raid.
That's amazing.
Yeah, they had, and this is fairly well known. What they would do, they could create an aerosol with coal dust, a combination of coal dust and a highly flammable gasoline gel, or it's not a gel, but it's more like an aerosol. So when a bomber would fly into it, the its own ignition would ignite this cloud of this aerosol, and you could obliterate, you know, dozens of planes in one blast. Especially because the bombers were flying in such close formation. Yeah, the Germans had been working on all kind of anti-bomber technologies, but what it was alleged that it was the that this aerosol was released in the skies ahead of the bombers by the Nazi saucers. But that was in Germany. That was not in the Antarctic.
Oh no, I didn't say it was. What I was saying was
okay.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you.
No, that's okay. What I was saying was I was so shocked that they had that technological capability, and then afterwards Germany supposedly, quote-unquote, lost the war, and they ended up moving camp. The story goes they moved, and I thought your report said that they moved to the Antarctic,
yeah.
Right?
Well, supposedly some of them did, yes. The Germans, as early as 1938, the Germans had invited Admiral Richard E. Byrd to join them in their original expedition to the Antarctic, which they called Neuschwabenland. And of course, and this is very interesting because Admiral Richard E. Byrd is a 33rd degree Freemason.
Just imagine that.
Funny thing. So and just prior to that, Byrd had flown an expedition to the North and South Pole both, where he and his pilot had dropped Masonic flags. So they were claiming the North and the South Pole not for America, but for the Freemasons.
I saw that. I was, like, kind of sickened.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what, for crying out loud, that's what Lewis and Clark were, a couple of Freemasons. They were scouting out North America, not for the pioneers or for the colonists. They were scouting out the resources that North America had for the Freemasons.
Oh, God.
That's like, you know, it's you know, these guys are a private club. And the rest of us are little kids, you know, looking in the candy store window.
Yeah, we're watching the movie, right?
That's right. That's right.
Well, hey, Jim, was there a correlation between the – you said there was a 250-foot diameter Honnebu Third Dreadnought.
Yeah.
And I saw that in April of 1945. Now, remember at the Olympics in Russia this year?
Yeah.
They supposedly came up with a dreadnought. I mean, is there a correlation between those two, some sort of message?
I don't know. I didn't see that. I didn't, what were they doing at, in the Olympics?
Supposedly, they say it was an Arcturian ship, but it was called a dreadnought.
No kidding.
And so when I saw this, when I was looking at your information, I thought, oh, that's an interesting.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, I'll have to dig into that one.
Yeah, there's some more dots to connect.
I know. So tell me, what do you know about New Schwabenland? I mean, what is currently being discussed about it now? Do we have any information on it now?
Well, whatever happened to New Schwabenland, as of today, the Antarctic has been divided up by countries all over the world. And the New Schwabenland area that was claimed by Germany during the war has reverted back to Norway. Now, I'm sure this is only the surface of the Antarctic that we're referring to. What is going on underneath the Antarctic may be a totally different story. It is alleged that there's... that the Germans created New Berlin in a vast cavern underneath the Antarctic. Hmm. And this is, of course, just pure speculation these days, but...
but I like speculation.
it was common knowledge. It was even published in German magazines and newspapers as early as, I think, 1943, or it had to be at least 43, that the Third Reich had great intentions, had deliberate intentions of colonizing the South Pole. And the German U-boat commander claimed that, yes, we have created a great citadel for our Führer at the South Pole. And there's stories about... a manifest of 100 Nazi U-boats that were never accounted for at the end of the war. And at least as early as 1943 that they were shipping, you know, armaments, they were shipping scientists, physicists, technicians, laborers down to the Antarctic. And so it's like, what has become of that since then? Is anybody's guess. Now, there's some interesting Russian speculation on some different websites that said that actually that New Berlin has a discreet embassy in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And it's very discreetly hidden in some building there, where only the insiders know how to access that embassy, but apparently that there, you know, somebody somewhere is exercising significant political clout on the planet that doesn't seem to have any identity.
That is amazing, and I'm still pondering the aspect that. They were able to wipe out 150 bombers. They had the technology that could have been a slam dunk end of the war, and yet they chose not to. I'm wondering, what's that all about?
Okay, well, the other thing about it, the Antarctic, is that it was believed to be Atlantis.
Okay, I've heard that before.
And there was a race that apparently there was a race between German secret societies and American secret societies to be the first ones to get to Atlantis. And it may well be that the Germans were the ones to do it.
Interesting. It looks like it.
And did they? It's almost as if, at least by late 1943, 1944, the Third Reich knew that the war in Europe was a lost cause. And so they dragged that war out just as a diversion. Yeah, a diversion for what was really going on in the Antarctic.
Now, when you say it was a lost cause, what do you – lost cause as in?
Well, in a lot of ways, because they could – actually, Germany could never really create the independent state that they wanted, being surrounded by the Russians and the Brits and the French. It's like Hitler's ideal was to have a continent all to themselves. Hitler was envious of the United States because we were an independent continent surrounded by oceans on each side where we could be a single people. Mm-hmm. This was Hitler's obsession. This is what he wanted to create. This was the this is his dream. And I think he realized that we'll never do that. We'll always be overrun by the Russians or the French or the Czechoslovakians or the Poles. We will never be a independent German-speaking people the way he wanted it to be. Hmm. And this was I suspect that this was even more Heinrich Himmler's dream, Himmler being the head of the SS, even more than Hitler's. And it would have been Heinrich Himmler who would have had the manpower and the scientific expertise to make this dream a reality at the Antarctic.
So, and it does state that Hitler himself actually had ET contact, right?
Well, Hitler claimed to have had contact with the Antichrist.
Okay, yes. I've heard that. Yeah, but I was wondering, did he have regular, conversations with, I'm not going to say Semyasi because he certainly wasn't of a positive nature, but did he have regular contact with, a particular race? Was there anything documented on that?
I don't know that he did. I know that he was, he had some, hallucinogenic experiences when he was, I think some of his handlers gave him something the equivalent of LSD or something. But actually, no, it was the Vril Society that was making direct contact with the extraterrestrials.
Yeah, now tell the audience a little more about the Vril Society, because I think that's a fascinating story. Please.
Okay, this is interesting because this is, one year after Aleister Crowley was working on the Amalantra rituals in New York, Maria Orsic and the ladies of the Vril Society in 1919 claimed to have made telepathic contact with an off-world civilization from the Aldebaran star system, which is in the constellation Taurus, and that these Aldebarans gave the Vril Society the technology to make flying saucers.
That was very cool when I saw that. Now, of course, they didn't want this to get in the wrong hands.
Of course not.
And were they successful in keeping it out of the wrong hands? I don't think so.
That's a good question. That's a very good question, because then you get into this gray area after World War II with Operation Paperclip, where you have all these high-ranking Nazi technologists or technicians and rocket designers suddenly show up in the United States working for Harry Truman.
And this is on the heels of a whole ton of them moving, supposedly, to the Antarctic.
Right.
That's the part that really got me today when I was reading through your stuff.
Okay, so did the flying disc technologies disappear in the Antarctic while the rocket technologies reappeared in the United States? And this is one of the things that Wendell Stevens was fairly adamant about in his research. He says, no, he says, we didn't just get rocket technology. We got the flying disc technology, too, but nobody dares to talk about it.
Interesting.
So he said, yeah, a lot of the so-called flying saucer crashes in the Southwest right after World War II, he says, no, they weren't extraterrestrial. They were Nazi technologies that we were trying to develop ourselves.
What do you think was the pivotal year that this all started?
Whew, there's a good question.
Because, I mean, the 40s are so laden with one experience after another, but...
Well, actually, if you'd asked me that a month ago, I would have said, well, probably this extraterrestrial contact with the Vril Society. But now, in retrospect, considering the portal that Aleister Crowley opened in 1904, I'm wondering if maybe that was the pivotal. Maybe it's exactly what Aleister Crowley said it was, that in 1904 it was the beginning of the Age of Horus, and that's what we're seeing, that all this flying saucer technology and this obsession with occult and Kabbalah within, you know, our contemporary society, it's like, it looks like he was right. He said that 1904 really did open the Aeon of Horus, and we're smack in the middle of it right now.
Is there a suggestion as to how long this age is going to last?
I'm not sure. I would think a long time. Okay. Crowley said that in the earlier years of the Aeon of Horus would be a lot of war, a lot of conflict, because Horus is young and immature. But as Horus gets older and more mature, that our society would become more peaceful and harmonious.
Interesting.
But I think, well, we ain't there yet. So.
So once again, we're getting back to the metaphysical, spiritual behavior of humanity as a whole.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's very interesting. Now you did talk about Admiral Byrd,
right,
aborting his mission. Now, did he abort the mission because he actually encountered the Germans and the Nazis? That's a big question out there. I know that a lot of people have talked about that. What's your opinion of that?
I got a lot of questions about that myself, and I think we're only getting part of the picture about the Operation High Jump that went to the South Pole, because all the newsreel footage and all the footage that I've ever seen of that expedition, I've never seen one military combat aircraft involved in that. And they said that, well, Admiral Byrd sent a whole military task force down there. Well, what good is a military task force if all you're taking is reconnaissance planes? You can't fight a combat operation with just reconnaissance planes. You would have to have combat aircraft. Now, according to the Russian documentary about the South Pole and Admiral Byrd, according to one eyewitness, and none of this have been able to verify, he claimed that there were Navy combat corsairs that were involved in dogfights with flying saucers at the South Pole. So I've never seen or never come across any verification that the aircraft carrier down there was actually carrying combat aircraft along with the reconnaissance aircraft that there's, you know, newsreel footage taking off from the aircraft's flight deck. So, you know, obviously the aircraft carrier could have had a full contingent of combat planes beneath the decks, but I've never seen any confirmation of that. So it's like, well, okay, how do you have a military combat task force without combat planes?
That's a really good point. Interesting. Well, and there too, they didn't.
No, anyway, if any of your listeners have information regarding the possibility that, yeah, the Admiral Byrd's task force did have combat airplanes and there's some way to verify that. Of course, the Navy can doctor all its records, you know, as it sees fit. Right. But if anybody can verify that, yeah, the Operation High Jump did have combat aircraft, I'd like to confirm that.
I know, I would too. And now, what did you think about the obsession with the Aryan race? You know, did that get back to the Nordics and the Venusians and that sort of thing? Or do you think there was more to it with Hitler's obsession about he wanted to have the pure Aryan race?
That was, I think that was Hitler's PR scam to gain control over the German people. And I can't understand, wasn't there at least one person in Germany who would look at Adolf Hitler and say, well, excuse me, sir, but you're not Aryan.
That's exactly right.
You're not a blue-eyed blonde. How the hell, you know, who the hell do you think you are telling us, the rest of us, we should be that when you're not that yourself?
I remember in high school and they were talking about this and I asked that exact question.
Right.
Just like, okay, where's this guy's blonde hair and blue eyes?
Come on. He was a mutt.
He
was a brown-eyed mutt. And who was allegedly a bastard son of one of the Rothschilds.
Yep.
So, come on, guy. It's like, you know, it's like, boy, it's like he sold the German people a bill of goods on that one. But that was not his sole invention. Actually, that was Madame Blavatsky, the Theosophist lady who claim to be in contact with the Ascended Masters or whatever from Tibet that told her about the supremacy of the Aryan race.
Yeah, she's amazing. I've read some of her material.
Now think about this one. I'm going to throw you a curveball here. The word Aryan and how similar it is to Orion. Orion, and this is within metaphysical circles, it's not important how a word is spelled as much as how it sounds.
That's right.
And I'm thinking, gee, Aryan sounds an awful lot like Orion. Orion. And so much of, you know, you can eventually link up German secret societies and occult belief systems, and eventually that all goes all the way back to Babylon and Egypt as well. So it's like, are the Aryans also from Orion, which they say the reptilians are from Orion? It's like, is there a connection with all of this?
Very interesting. Good point. Good point. Now I'm gonna jump a little bit towards General Douglas MacArthur,
who, oh, yeah,
honestly, when I was in high school, I just really revered that man.
Sure.
I just loved his speech and the fact that he was fired and he walked away. Now, one of the things I was not aware of was that he had his own interplanetary phenomena unit. Can you tell us a little more about that? I mean, did he collect so much data that it was almost a threat to the military that were trying to, you know, to oppress all this information?
Well, I got that information from Bill Cooper's book, The Behold a Pale Horse, and he claimed this is information he saw when he read the Naval Intelligence briefing paper when he was in Vietnam. And I don't know, maybe your dad saw a briefing paper too. But anyway, there was a lot of activity in the Pacific, allegedly, that MacArthur was keeping an eye on. And MacArthur's problem was he was pretty much his own man.
Yes.
And he was not, I don't think he had any regard for Harry Truman whatsoever.
I don't either. But at the same time, in some ways, did you blame him? Because that was right around the time of the United Nations and the fact that he would have to tell him ahead of time where he was going to be, you know, strategically placing his men, and then he would get there, and the enemy would already be waiting for him.
Right, right.
You know?
Well,
so you can't blame him for the fact that it was such a scam to begin with.
Yeah, he and General Patton ran into the same problems, I think. Patton realized very late in the war about the United Nations scam and giving America's, you know, power away to the United Nations. And I don't think I know Patton was not happy with that, and certainly General MacArthur, you know, he was virtually the emperor of Japan after World War II. So it's like, you know, what do I need Harry Truman for? Oh, yeah, okay. The problem, I think, with MacArthur was that he was too outspoken and that he was not about to be told what to do by Harry Truman or the CIA.
Oh, yes.
And so if he wanted to talk publicly about flying saucers, he would. And you understand, this is the same time that they created MJ-12, and MJ-12 was trying to keep a lid on all the UFO stuff. So I'm sure it probably wouldn't be seemly to kill General MacArthur, but we will fire him and make sure that he stays quiet. And
but he didn't.
Well, he didn't. He didn't. And he talked about the nations of the world will have to unite for the next war will be an interplanetary war. You have to ask yourself, well, what did he know that the rest of us didn't know that would make him make a statement like that?
Well, and the fact that he was fired. I mean, you know, sure. It had to go a lot deeper
sure.
than that.
Sure.
And
sure.
they didn't take him out. So you have
right.
to figure he must have had something on them.
Right, yeah. And it's like, well, and those, you know, you go back a couple years earlier when former Defense Secretary James Forrestal was sent to Bethesda Naval Hospital because he wanted to talk.
Mm.
He wanted to spill the beans. He didn't feel like these were secrets that should be kept for the American people. And of course, he allegedly falls from the 16th floor of his hospital room at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And of course, they said that was suicide. So, yeah, it's like...
Sounds a lot like the bankers these days. You know, they decide to kill themselves by jumping out of a 28-story building, you know.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I think that you could think of a better way to kill yourself, frankly, but...
Well, unless you had help being thrown out the window.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
Speaking of MJ-12,
mm-hmm.
when I interviewed Ron Garner, he made the statement that, the name escapes me. Darn. He said that his close personal friend had made it very clear that the MJ-12 want disclosure. I said, what? He said, oh, yes, they want disclosure. They want to start bringing this information out. What is your take on that?
Okay. Well, we could go a couple different directions on this one. I remember talking to Bob Dean about this. You know Bob Dean.
Oh, I love Bob Dean.
Bob Dean said, within MJ-12 or within the CIA, where there's two factions. There's one faction that wants to release this all to the public. And then there's another faction that would rather see us all dead than to ever release this information. So it's like you have that dichotomy where, okay, some do and some don't. And over the years, it seems like the ones that don't have always prevailed.
Interesting.
On a certain level. But then on another level, I don't know if you're familiar with the alleged Ronald Reagan briefing document where he was briefed in right after he took office in the early 80s. By the CIA director, William Casey, all about the flying saucer issue. And what Reagan was told is that, well, rather than making an official government statement about extraterrestrials, he says, we filter this information through the entertainment media. So on one hand, you have the government is denying the existence of this reality. On the other hand, the entertainment media is just flooding, you know, movies, TVs, magazine, everything about flying saucers and extraterrestrials. So it's like, well, it's a backdoor program to educate the population about extraterrestrials.
It's like soft disclosure.
soft disclosure, but it also is disclosure that you can put your own special spin on it that you can use later on if you need to create a false flag alien invasion. Absolutely. You can do that, right?
Absolutely. And, of course, keep the fear porn going.
Bingo. Right.
Well,
so the military-industrial complex requires huge monolithic enemies to justify its existence. So in this day and age, what would be the most beneficial monolithic enemy to threaten the planet but extraterrestrials?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And it's like, according to Stephen Greer, they're manufacturing the extraterrestrials themselves so we can have an army to fight.
Yeah, it's just to keep the whole conflict.
Just to keep the whole mix stirred up.
The only, you know, going back to MJ-12, the fact that Vannevar Bush, and the fact that, you know, all of the Bushes are still a major player in this. Now, of course, Senior apparently just died, which, you know, did he or did he really, you know?
Yeah, I haven't gotten confirmation on that yet.
Yeah, you know, that's always a big question mark, considering.
Well, you know, George Jr., his mother is a daughter to Aleister Crowley.
Whoa. Barbara Bush?
Barbara Bush, yep.
Wow.
And I dare you to go find a picture of Aleister Crowley in his later years and match it up with Barbara Bush, and they are dead ringer for each other.
Oh, my God.
And Marvin Bush looks just like Aleister Crowley, too.
So, therefore, the magician / Freemason /
Skull and Bonesman.
The dots continue to connect.
Exactly.
That's crazy. Now, you know, another burning question I have for you is this whole thing with the Roswell crash of 1947, do you really, truly believe that this really took the presidency off guard? I mean, do you really think that they were like, oh, my God, we're in total chaos, confusion. This really is, this could be the end of the, you know, the human race, et cetera.
I'm not sure. And this goes back to this whole issue of the Aeon and of Horus, and what did the government know and when did they know it, and how much did the OSS, which became the CIA, how much did they know about Aleister Crowley's sex magic rituals and opening portals and contacting extraterrestrials? It's like, how much did they know about this to begin with?
That's what I'm saying.
And it's like, has all of this been structured to flow right along with Aleister Crowley's dark magic to begin with? Listen, I have been chipping away at this for 44 years, like I said, and within the last 2 months, with all this research I've done on Crowley and Parsons and NASA and all this, it's thrown all the old stuff into a cocked hat. And it's like, you have to go back and refigure the whole thing all over again from scratch. Because there's this huge chunk of information that the UFO community was never told.
Yes.
And it's like, now factor this into everything else you've learned.
Oh,
and it's like, I don't know what to think now.
I think, Jim, you've done such an outstanding job in presenting the core key events that connected to one another. That's the part I just loved about your website.
Thank you.
You know, just by the way, everybody, make sure you visit Jim's website. It's thewebmatrix.net, right?
Well, or you can go to jimnicholsufo.net. The Web Matrix, that's the site that I think that's also linked to Dan Willis's website.
Well, it's good stuff. You guys
love it. If you want to read a great blog, go to read Dan Willis, the Dan Willis blog. Because he was one of the original speakers at the Disclosure Conference when they had their first conference.
Oh, cool.
and he was with Naval Intelligence and so forth. So he has a lot of really wonderful, incredible information to share as well.
Well, now back to Roswell.
Okay. Yeah.
One of the most, you know, kind of like the lioness Atolled, which, you know, it took me about 48, 72 hours to process the information in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
The audio of the recording of the interview with the actual alien from the crash of Roswell. And they referred to her, I'm going to put that in parentheses, as Errol. A-R-L.
Okay.
Did you hear that one?
No, I haven't heard that one.
You got to hear that one. It's about a 4.5 hour, and it's kind of hard to find sometimes. They take it down, and then somebody else tries to find it, put it back up. But I remember two things in particular that she stated. One was that, yes, I understand you all read history, but if you understood that the true reason why history repeats itself, and that goes back to what Rose, you know, Yellow Rose,
right,
Texas says.
Yes.
Which is, yeah, I mean, it was like, wow, that was a total confirmation where she was saying, basically, you know, they just use the Ankh, they put everybody to sleep, they take mm-hmm. all, you know, they take
yes.
they take the names, they change them to different
okay.
names, and they're the same
uh-huh.
people. You know, that was yeah. one of them.
Yeah. yeah.
That was pretty prolific when I first heard that.
The other thing, and which also relates to what she was talking about, the planets being on, what did she call?
Poles. Yeah.
And seven planets, right?
Yeah, which you've got the seven candlesticks
right.
in the Vatican.
Bingo. In the in the Kabbalah also, in the Jewish ritual, you have the seven candles. So it's like, oh, okay, well, there's something important about this also.
Well, I think the other thing about that video that was really good to see was the whole different perspective of seeing a solar flare.
Right.
Completely different scenario now when you see that the sun is erupting. And the fact that as one of my friends told me, the solar flares greatly impact the divine masculine on the planet. Every time we have a solar flare, it's affecting the masculine within all of us to become more balanced, believe it or not.
Okay.
And the full moons, of course, are affecting the divine feminine.
Ouch.
Yeah, so you're – and that's in everybody, of course. So,
I hurt – when we have these super moons, I just ache like a toothache.
Well, hey, it's all that good cellular memory stuff that you've carried from one timeline to another.
Oh, I feel like somebody's hitting me with a hammer.
Well, I think everybody's going through that. We're all purging a ton right now. But, gosh.
Also, getting back to the candlesticks, in the Kabbalah, according to the Kabbalah ritual, whatever, there were only seven planets. There were only seven planets.
Well, she agrees with that.
And
of course, the other thing that's very interesting is it opens up a whole discussion about, well, what are the planets? If the planets
right.
have consciousness and if they're beings,
right.
do
right.
these planets literally represent the gods that actually came here in a physical form at one time?
Right. And, of course, the planets each give off their own special music.
Mm-hmm.
Each planet gives off its own sound vibrational signature.
Yeah.
And according to HARP, HARP was designed to interfere so that sound frequency doesn't reach the Earth.
Now, what's your take on HARP? Do you think it's still full steam ahead? I mean, there's been all these rumors about taking down the Alaskan
I don't know.
Facility.
I still see the chemtrails up there today, so it's like you can say they're taking it down, but I ain't convinced yet.
I have to say though, Jim, have you noticed we've had a lot of clear skies? Now the last 2 days have been really bad, really bad chemtrails.
Okay,
today and yesterday.
Yeah, today's the first day I've seen chemtrails in probably a month.
Yeah, it's been really clean and clear, so.
Yeah.
We are making progress in the chemtrail area.
I should hope so.
And if you look really carefully at the chemtrails and then what appears around them, you can actually see the galactics dissipating them.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
It's very interesting. Once you really look at it and see the different cloud formations that get involved afterwards. But anyway, so back to, this is something I wanted to ask you about, was Colonel Philip Corso.
Yes.
Wow. Now, he was talking about how you really needed to be careful because the agreement that Truman had made with the so-called Zetas, right? Zeta Reticuli?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. That they were very unfriendly and that they were actually genetically altered human automatons.
Yes.
Wow. So can you talk a little bit about what exactly did he mean by cloned biological entities?
He meant just that. We interviewed him about that, and we asked him, I says, what do you mean they look like clones? And he says they didn't look like clones. They were clones. He says they were made by some other intelligence. And he was very cagey about how he phrased that. He said by some other intelligence. He didn't say extraterrestrial intelligence. He just said they were cloned by some other intelligence. So I think, well, you know, you stop and think about that, that could go in all kinds of different directions.
Sure.
It could have been some other intelligence. Could have been Dr. Joseph Mengele, for God's sake. These could be creatures that were, part of genetics experiments in Germany during World War II. You know, everybody always talks about, the flying disc technologies and all that stuff and how that relates to the UFOs, but nobody ever talks about how the eugenics experiments were also possibly relating to the alleged extraterrestrials that we were seeing. So there's a whole other chunk of information that needs to be looked into here. Actually, in Joseph Farrell's book, Roswell and the Reich, he does broach the possibility that, the so-called little gray aliens were in fact modified human fetuses that were modified in some kind of genetics experiment. And even Dr. Carla Turner made the same observation just before they killed her. So,
right, I remember that woman. Well, two things. When they were interviewing the nurse,
yes,
during the Errol interview,
right. Yes,
Errol actually stated that the vessel that she was in was some sort of kind of cloning vehicle that would, it was holding the consciousness from some other intelligence. And she mentioned how that was actually representing the UFO itself. That intelligence actually flew the UFO that crashed.
Oh, that their consciousness was directly linked to the UFO.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought
that
was really cool.
Uh-huh. I've heard David Wilcock speak about that also.
You were talking about the modified human fetuses. When you look at a gray, that was always something that I always wondered, like, good God, was this created in a laboratory?
Exactly.
And if it was, what the hell were they thinking?
Well, even the alleged alien in the alleged autopsy film, I've looked at that and it's like, well, it doesn't look that much unhuman. It looks human, but it looks like a deformed human, but it doesn't look that much like something that you would call alien. I've seen deformed people, on this planet that look more alien than that creature did in that autopsy film.
Well, so this brings up a very hot topic, which is, how do you think those relate to the Archons?
Vehicles for the Archons.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So you agree that
yes.
they are?
Yeah. that the Archon, one of the main goals of the Archons is just to have, since they're hyperdimensional, what they want is vehicles that they can use to operate in this dimension. Mm. And so that would perfectly serve that.
And tell us a little bit, you talked briefly in one of your blogs about Nash, and he was talking about how Sophia was so anxious to take a physical form that she, you know, talk a little bit about that. I thought that was really cool.
John Lash.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in my Alien Invaders from Space, the Archon Alien Invaders, or Archons Invaders from Space, right?
Right, right.
Archons, that's a great book. John Lash has written a terrific book called Not in His Image, which really explores the history of Gnosticism, and it's really the Nag Hammadi scrolls that were found in Egypt in 1945 that tell this story of the Archons. And this, you know, this is, of course, largely dismissed by Christian academics as being, you know, science fiction. But it's in the Gnostics were able to access hyperdimensional realms, so they came to understand what the Archons were and what their agenda was here. And they Archons are hyperdimensional parasitic entities that feed off the human energy. And at the end of the day, I still agree with John Lash that planet Earth and the human experiment here is that we are nothing more than somebody's
piece of meat.
Cattle farm,
yeah.
Where we are being harvested for our psychic or our life force energy.
I so agree. Yeah, our ectoplasm, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Our ether.
Yeah. Isn't that special?
Yeah. So our whole, and his argument is that there's through the hierarchy of secret societies and the people in the highest levels of government, corporate, entertainment industries are actually nothing more than proxies or cutouts to serve the agenda of the Archons. And that's why we see the wars, endless wars, the degradation of the planet, riots in Missouri and all this stuff. This is all part of the ongoing Archon agenda to feed off the negative entity or energies of the human population. That we're a food source for somebody else.
And this is why it is so great that all the bloggers out there are doing their bit to expose these false flags,
right,
to these actors that are playing out these fear porn roles.
Sure.
Right on. I commend all of them out there.
Yes.
I think the part that really hit me, oh my God, did this hit me, was when you were talking about the Inquisition.
Yes.
And the core reason behind the Inquisition,
mm-hmm,
was the fact that the Gnostics had knowledge of this archontic realm.
Right.
And they wanted to nip that in the bud.
Sure.
I mean, that's how important it was.
It is important to keep the human population as ignorant of this as possible. The more ignorant the population is, the easier it is for them to, you know, to manage the little cattle farm here. The more people understand and know, the more difficult it is to manage the farm. And this is, you know, this is the ultimate challenge for the human race, is to discover this and rise above it.
Yes.
And say, we are sovereign entities, and I'm sorry, but you don't have the right to feed on my energies.
This is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart, because
sure,
we do an awful lot of bioetheric removals and implant
right,
removals, and
so you know firsthand what,
oh
what
my
this
God,
is the real deal, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the stuff that we see and hear, and the stuff that I hear from the healers that are doing
sure,
this is
sure,
it's amazing. I mean, there's no turning back for me. Let's just put it that
uh-huh,
way.
Right,
now, the
right,
other part I was really just amazed at was Jesus, you said, Jesus, if Morgenthau had been a prophet of Amor, the principle of love, and when inverted or perverted into power, it became Roma or Rome.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Right.
And then you talked about the Rex Mundi.
Rex Mundi, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, the Gnostics saw the Vatican as being the living embodiment of Rex Mundi, being the Lord of the material world. And that's, that's the whole essence, is to keep people locked and dazzled by materialism. And so they never stopped to ask about, well, what about my spirituality? Well, that's not important. There's no money in your spirituality, this is the great distraction, and this is, this is one of the great techniques that they use to keep the human race distracted and ignorant and easy prey.
I think that's backfired somewhat, because so many people on the planet are now in a state of financial crisis.
Yeah.
And they're finally getting, they have been forced.
They're disaffected with materialism. Yeah,
exactly. They're getting to that place like, God, sure, it's more of a pain in the butt to have to have credit cards and a big house and a huge mortgage and, all the toys.
Yeah.
So it's actually, I just want to put that out there, that it's been a vehicle in order for us to regain our spirituality again.
Exactly, right. Well, John Lash says that, this is the game that's in play right now. And this is where we have to honor Sophia, and we have to honor Sophia's original intention for us, because by overcoming this archonic influence or these archonic parasites, we will fulfill her original intention for the human race.
Oh, wow. How exciting is that?
But it's like, I'm sorry, you got to roll up your sleeves and do it yourself. I mean, we all got to do it together.
Yes, we do.
It's like, I think of the Harry Potter movie, Order of the Phoenix,
mm-hmm,
where they realize they're being overwhelmed by the Dark Lord and his minions. And it's like, well, Harry, it's up to you. It's like, you're the only one that can teach us how to protect ourselves now. So it's like, well, we all got to get together and become Dumbledore's army here.
Yeah, no kidding. And it is happening. So
That's exactly the position we're in right now.
It's really, really exciting to be alive at this time. And I do want to let you know, we're getting to the top of the hour, and I just wanted to give you a last shot at whatever you want to leave us with.
Last shot. Well, getting back to the let's see here. I just wanted to get back to the NASA, the Aeon of Horus thing, just one little bit. There's one piece here where NASA just kind of lets it all hang out here. Their next big program, our space program, which asteroid, landing a robot on an asteroid in 2016, and the name of the mission is OSIRIS-REx.
Incredible.
So it's like they're just letting it all hang out. Yeah, this is who we are. We are secret society obsessed with OSIRIS, occultism. And so our next big mission is OSIRIS-REx, King Orion.
Amazing. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you tonight, Jim. And I would hope to be able to pull you back on, because there's so much more information that we could be going over.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And let's stay in touch. And for all of you out there listening, please support Jim in any way you can. Visit his site. Go ahead, Jim, and tell them both of your sites again.
Well, it's jimnicholsufo.net, JIMNICHOLS.net. And be sure to go to my UFO TV YouTube links. And I've got seven really entertaining, informative videos that you can watch on YouTube. And I highly recommend them, and I think you'll get a lot of information and a lot of entertainment from those.
Well, thank you for all the research that you've done, because it's enlightened us, and we appreciate all that you do.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thank you for doing that. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I love all of you. You're an awesome audience. I know you get tired of hearing that, but it's true. Can't deny it. And we will see you next Tuesday, same time, same place. Take care and have an awesome rest of your day. Take care. Thanks, Jim. Bye.